Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, speaking on a telephone today and tomorrow, but back into our regular studio, which has been completely redone and is now just one of the state-of-the-art television, movie, and film and radio broadcasting studios in New York. And we have also expanded and are including a new 100 producers doing 100 new shows on specifically and exclusively progressive themes from around the world. So we've been working on this for a long time, and now it's here. And by the way, if you don't think there's a lot of people who are progressive and first becoming independent from both the corporate establishment, Democrats and Republicans, there's more independents today than there are Democrats and Republicans who voted in the last election. So there's a lot of us, and we're simply not going to accept the duopoly of a two-party system and the politics of identity and the separation and the destruction of our culture by those who profit by putting people against each other. We need to heal. We need to come together. We need to galvanize our strengths and our wisdom to fight global warming and the ravages of diseases and aging and the destruction of our economies. And we can't do that unless we unite in a common cause. And that's what we're doing. So that all starts on Monday. Today, however, on our sister station, WBAI, we're going to give you some insights on why a mother's stress level affects the baby through the amniotic fluid from the University of Zurich and about 15 other major studies, always from peer-reviewed journals, always citing the studies. And why do I do that and have done that my entire career? Because long ago in a debate, and this went back to Atlanta, Georgia, 1972. I was debating a group of physicians, all of whom knew who I was. I had no pre-knowledge of them. And I heard one of the producers. I had just flown in overnight from Los Angeles. I thought I was there to talk about organic gardening. And instead, I heard a producer say, "Ready for the bloodletting?" And I said, "What bloodletting?" And this producer laughed at me and said, "Yours." And I didn't know what he was talking about until I was invited out on the set, and here was this group of medical doctors with folders on the Gary Null file and how I was misleading people about organic and these other things that had no benefit, like fiber. Quote, "Only pigs and cattle need fiber." Yeah, that's what I was told. And that was by a top representative of the AMA. So that was an interesting debate. And after the debate, and I found out all those people had been supported by Coca-Cola, which is headquarters there in Atlanta, and I was on a tour talking about the dangers of soft drinks and fluoride in the water and DDT, which was just to be banned that year. We'd been fighting Rachel Carson, who was really, for all intents and purposes, the entire environmental movement, rested on her shoulders. She was the courageous person. She is a true American hero. And no one knows her better in today's schools, and they should, because she was a marine biologist, and she found that DDT, a toxic pesticide, which was sprayed. I remember when they actually went up and down the streets when I was a kid and sprayed it. And they would go to a swimming pool, and all the kids would be in the swimming pool, and they'd spray all the kids with DDT. Like, it was a fun thing to do. And we didn't realize how absolutely toxic it was. Well, the same company that gave us DDT also gave us Agent Orange and Dieldrin and Heptachlor and all these other toxic pesticides. Anyhow, I was out there and talking about what was wrong with the way we were eating and the beverages we were drinking and cigarette smoke. At that time, remember, there had been no lawsuit ever lost by Big Tobacco. And they controlled the science. And so after the debate, one of the doctors came over to me, And he said, look, clearly you were unprepared. You had none of the science. I said, I didn't know I was supposed to be here in a debate. Had I known, I would have brought some scientific references. He said, well, in the future, always have your scientific references, because it's going to come down to this. The public is always going to believe a doctor rather than a lay person. That's how we're conditioned, and that's not going to change. He was right. He still is right. And if a doctor has scientific studies, and you have studies that are based upon anecdotal evidence, well, I ate a better diet and I felt better. And the doctor says, all diets are the same. And not one's going to make you feel any better than the other. They're going to believe the doctor. And so that was my first real, and it was beneficial to me. I took a Greyhound bus back to New York, and all the way back I kept thinking, I better do everything based upon orthodox science, because then when they're arguing, they're going to be arguing against themselves, against their own data. And that's why every single program I do, every lecture I do, I always start by citing the peer-reviewed literature and the scientific institutions. So if someone say, well, that doesn't sound right, well, then go to the University of Zurich and go to the peer-reviewed journal that's on PubMed to publish their results and take issue with them. I'm merely the provider of that information. So if someone wants to know, why do I cite it all the time? It's because those who don't cite are never taken credibly. And I want you to have confidence in the information. I want you to use it. Also today, Julian Assange is very sick. He's probably going to die. And the mainstream media doesn't know that because they don't want to know it. They would be embarrassed by how he's never once been found wrong of giving misinformation, not once. 10,000 reports that he has released, and not a single one has been an error. So his only crime is not rape. There was never a challenge, and he was never cited by any court, not including in Sweden. He didn't take refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy to hide from rape allegations. To the contrary, that was he took refuge because of the politics that was going on. In fact, interesting, I actually read the transcripts of the women who met with the special police and prosecutors, and not once was there a citation that he had forcibly raped them or did anything. In fact, one had a whole lot of sex with her, with Julian Assange, at her instigation, and she's acknowledging this. So how did this come about? Oh, because one of the women also happened to have links with the CIA. Did any of the mainstream media happen to pick that one up? And how did she suddenly finagle herself into all this? But still, it had nothing to do with rape, and even after they refused to bring charges after he was interviewed by the special prosecutor in the Ecuadorian embassy, yet that's what the mainstream media will go by. Now, Julian Assange's only crime, his only crime, is that he exposed crimes. He committed none. And what he did is no different than the New York Times or the Washington Post, the very hypocritical organizations that are not standing behind him, but used his material when it was to their convenience. So think of that for a moment. Let's just stop and wrap our mind around this concept. You're put into prison. You spend 6.5 to 7 years in an embassy for all intents and purposes, as a prisoner. And you've committed no crime, been found guilty of no crime. You've not been convicted of anything. In fact, you haven't even been charged, except right now, in some stupid, deep state effort to get him back. But he did one thing, and that one thing got him into deep trouble. He was the one who leaked the 22,000 emails of John Podesta, and in those emails, it showed where Hillary Clinton had done many things. For example, she was the one who was secretly meeting on 44 separate occasions with different countries, pushing the Trans-Pacific Partnership against the unions, against the American people, and for the people that would later be paying her to go in and do stupid little lectures and giving her massive amounts of money. She was also shown in there to have threatened a every European country and other countries, you better take GMO foods. If not, there's going to be repercussions and retaliation. Now, was this the Russians? No. On five separate occasions, Julian Assange has stated, I have never taken anything from the Russians or their emissaries or anyone associated with the Russians. This did not come from Russia. Where did it come from? How did he get these 22,000 reports? Simple. It was a man named Seth Rich. He was a young Bernie Sanders, quiet Bernie Sanders supporter. He supported Bernie Sanders, but he worked inside the Democratic National Office in Washington, D.C. And he saw that what they were doing against Sanders, who was in the lead and would have been and should have been the Democratic nominee and would have easily beaten Trump, that he was being undermined unethically and illegally. And so he became so outraged by this, he downloaded materials. He then met with a Craig Murray, former UK ambassador, I think it was Uzbekistan or one of the Russian old Russian colonies, and he met with him in the park right across from American University, and he handed him all the information and documents and explained why he was doing it. Murray was friends with Julian Assange and gave him to Julian Assange. Then later, William Binney and nine other top National Security Agency analysts, I mean the brain trust of those who also became whistleblowers, reviewed all of the computer data and said it would have been impossible for the Russians to have done this without there being a fingerprint. There was no fingerprint. And they said Russia did not leak these documents. So there's a whole group of people who know that the truth was that this man inside the DNC did it. But the DNC would not allow the FBI, the Justice Department, which is overseeing the FBI. People may not be aware, but the FBI is in a direct control of the Justice Department. The FBI cannot, impanel a grand jury. The Justice Department can. They're supposed to do the research and find out what crimes have been committed and then turn it over to the Justice Department. In any case, the DNC would not turn over their computers and their hard drives. Why not? What do you got to hide? They wouldn't do it. So, to this day, the mainstream media has led the world on this bogus, the Russians did it. Well, they didn't. And we have interfered in 69 separate votes around the world. Not a word about that. Israel has done more spying and interference in our elections than any other country of the world based on independent research. Not a word about that. And then this Seth guy ends up getting killed. They said it was a robbery attempt. Gee, there were no witnesses, no security cameras where he was shot, but they didn't seem to think that taking the money out of his wallet, taking a wristwatch, taking some jewelry, was a part of the robbery. They just killed him. Wow, what a coincidence. So anyhow, Assange is very sick. I'm going to do a little tribute to his martyrdom through Chris Hedges today. Also today from our archives, we're going to go to, why does Rachel Maddow want the United States to invade, attack, and create war with Venezuela? How can any liberal justify this, knowing that we've been trying to regime change with Maduro, as we did with his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, for a long time? And yet that's what's going on. We'll give you that story. Why are they trying to destroy Max Blumenthal, one of the most respected and honored true investigative journalists in the world? And also, Dr. Ronald Melnick challenges the idea that we're using safe cell phones. We're not. So we got a lot to share today. and tomorrow. And so we're going to begin by taking a look at the latest on health and healing. Now, this first study is important. And why is it important? I remember once a person came to see me, someone who I am familiar with. I know this person and know their background. And this is a high-stress person. I mean, hyperkinetic, volatile, emotional. And this person was very sick and asked, could I help? And I did. And after protocol, they were able to get out of harm's way. And then the person said that they wanted with their life partner to have a child. And one question. Knowing that anything and everything you think and feel emotionally will be transferred into that developing fetus as your mother's, and going back seven generations, the epigenetic influences of what a person was experiencing can be experienced by the child. Do you really want to have a child at this time when there's so much volatility in your life and you seem to be constantly at war with the world? Everything is a crisis. Everything is a problem, because that means you're extremely stressed. And all that stress is going to go right into that developing child. And person stopped for a moment and said, well, I can control that. I said, until such time that you control your anger, your rage, and this sense of victimhood, I would put off having a child. And that was advice I would give anyone for the same reasons. And also, I believe you should take at least a year for an intentional pregnancy for the man and woman to detoxify completely. I mean, really clean up your diet, a healthy, organic, plant-based diet, detoxify your body for the man to rebuild so he has healthy sperm, because you don't want a defective sperm that can cause a problem. In any case, this is what this study is showing, that if the mother is stressed over a longer period of time during pregnancy, the concentration of stress hormones in amniotic fluid rises, as proven by an interdisciplinary team of researchers from the University of Zurich. So that's important. Now, what I'm going to do is, Michael G., we're going to go to a video, and I'm going to come back and do a video on health. Let's go to the first one, Professor Jordan talking about why the hate campaign against men is creating some very unstable young men. Let's go to that now. Back in a moment.
Backlash against masculinity, and a sense that there's something toxic about masculinity.
What is this idea of being over? Why is society overly feminized?
Well, I didn't ever say that society was overly feminized. So if we're going to discuss my views, we should use my actual words. I believe that there's a danger in our society at the moment of making the assumption that our culture, for example, is a tyrannical patriarchy, which it is in some small part, and that any active engagement on the part of young men in particular is indistinguishable from an unacceptable power and dominance drive, which I don't believe.
But surely,
I think
all of that is inappropriate
and incorrect.
If much of the power and authority over a very long historical period has lain with men, mm-hmm. isn't it only inevitable that some men will get a little hacked off when women are given a stab at something approaching equality?
Well, that could be inevitable, but that doesn't make it right, and it's certainly not something that I support. So so
you think men's resentment is more important than women's effort to attain equality?
I'm not in favor of resentment at all. I think that if you're resentful, something's definitely wrong. Either you need to grow the hell up and take stock of your life, or you have some things to say to people that you haven't been saying.
You say science undoubtedly shows us that men and women have different traits, and there's a lot of science to back you up on mm-hmm. that. But you say that because of that, men are hardwired to achieve success and to be successful in a way that women are not.
No, not at all. I've never said anything like that. I've said that there are biological differences between men and women that express themselves in temperament and in occupational choice, and that any attempt to enforce equality of outcome is unwarranted and ill-advised as a consequence.
And yet some of the most successful societies, judged on contentment indices or indeed material success, are those, for example, in Scandinavia.
Where the temperamental differences between men and women are larger than they are in any other society.
Well, so you say, you point out that in Scandinavia many more women choose to be health workers than engineers, for example.
It's not what I say, it's what the large-scale scientific investigation has revealed.
Fair enough. But equally, Scandinavia is full of societies, one could point to Norway, where they've made a specific legislative effort, for example, with a quota of 40% of women on corporate boards or a quota for women to be in parliament.
Right.
They've specifically engaged in social engineering, and it seems to be working, and it seems to
doesn't seem to be working particularly.
Forgive me, but Norway is top of every contentment index that we see across the world.
Well, okay, so first of all, Norway has plenty of oil money, which is definitely contributing to that. And second, it depends on what you mean by working. There's no evidence, for example, that the legislation that was designed to increase the number of women on boards has produced any movement whatsoever in the number of women who hold managerial and administrative positions in Norway. The theory was that as societies became more egalitarian, that men and women would become more the same. But that isn't what's happened. What's happened is the biggest differences between men and women now, temperamentally and in terms of their own interest, have manifested themselves in the Scandinavian countries. And so what that will mean is that men and women will make different choices in occupation if you let them have free choice. Now, what are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to stop that from happening? Is that the feminist perspective?
Let's get back to a word I used before and ask you directly. Do you approve of... Do you think it's a dangerous word, equality? This word equality.
I approve of equality of opportunity, but I think that equality of outcome considerations are detestable and dangerous beyond belief.
Okay, there you have a short clip from Professor Jordan Peterson, a controversial person. And whether we agree or disagree with him in part or whole, or the people who are the defenders of the orthodoxy challenging him, this needs to be discussed when we are now approaching a point of view where just being a man, in and of itself, doesn't matter what color you are, is a negative. Doesn't matter whether you're a gentle, kind, thoughtful, loving, caring, empathetic person, you're judged as if the worst examples of excessive, hormone extreme male aggression represents an entire species of men, and it doesn't. Nor could you say the same thing for women. There are some alpha women and alpha men. Do you judge the people that run a corporation or the military or politicians and how they got there with everyone else of the same background, the same ethnicity, the same, let's say, religious? Do you judge all people of a religion based upon what one subset will do in the name of that same religion, which would be diametrically opposite of what a reasonable person would ever do? Why don't we have those that represent a moderate, humanistic, and more spiritually balanced approach be out there as examples of what it means to be a human being and work together with other people instead of constantly demeaning, bashing, trashing one another? Because then there are going to be people who immediately seize upon that. And more often than not, these are people who in their own right have not done the work necessary to create positive solutions. There's a whole generation of hate-mongering going on in our country right now. And these people do not represent everyone else, and yet they act as if they do. And I believe that if we start our children off by making them feel that somehow they are inferior, they are less than, they must always go through life bowing down and apologizing for just being born. And there are those who want that exactly to happen. We want you to apologize for being born. You are never worthy. Why not? Why are you my judge? What gives you the right to be my judge? You have no right to judge me except by my actions and the quality of my character and the dynamic and dimensions of my spiritual values. That you can judge. But my right to exist, except to be subservient to some identity politics stupidity? No, that you don't have a right to. And we're going to continue to have this conversation because we're not having it anywhere else. All we have are people who come together with their pitchforks and their battle axes and want to whack at everything that they disagree with or do not have the courage to exemplify by higher standards and higher ideals. And I'm sick of it. And therefore, I'm going to bring it up. We can agree or disagree upon what these people represent, but we need to start acting like human beings who care for one another instead of looking at someone there, and if that other person's not the same color, doesn't have the same clothes, doesn't have the same hairstyle, doesn't have the same educational background, doesn't have the same financial status, that somehow they are the other and are less valued as human beings. In my world, everyone's a sacred human being until they choose not to be. Now, back to a little more health information. So do we understand what I said before? Because this is really important. And I say this is important because I see too many people, including my own friends, who decided after they had a successful career, now to they want a kid. Why do you want a kid? Why don't you adopt a kid? Why don't you be big first? Why don't you try being a big brother or big sister? Spend quality time with a child and see if you have the patience, the understanding. Do you have the capacity for guidance to be with that child every day? Because so many people of my generation had children not because they wanted children. Of course, a lot do. And they didn't know or take the time to see what it means to be a good parent. Are you going to give that child time at each stage of its development until it's on its own when it needs you to be there? Are you going to be there for the child? Or is this just another trophy? It's just another one of those golden rings that you can show that somehow you've done it. And of course, then what are you going to do if you're not the right parent for that child? Child has no say-so in it. And look at all the children today that are unhappy because the people that should be there to give them unconditional love and time aren't. They're too busy. The careerists. God, do I counsel so many careerists. You have no idea. I probably counseled 50,000 careerists. They're a mess. They are an absolutely steaming pile of mess. They're successful. They're wealthy. They're privileged in their own mind and clueless about who they are at their heart and soul. They can tell you about their career, and they push their children to no measure of allowing them to develop under their own. They've got to be an extension of the ego of the child, and the child grows up one day and succeeds. Child is a 4-point school average, maybe legitimately so. Of course, they've gotten counseled and they've gotten tutors. Makes a big difference when you have someone tutoring you and counseling you and giving you endless hours of how to take a test. So you finally become valedictorian, and everybody's happy and brags, and that's another trophy. And then you begin to believe it as a kid, and you go to Harvard, and wow, now you get deeply depressed because there are 5,000 other kids there just equally as smart and equally as motivated. And now even a 4-point average doesn't matter, and you're committing suicide. Yeah, look at the suicide rates at Ivy League schools with 4-point students. They're the ones most likely to commit suicide. Because you can be a 4-point student coming from a middle-class background where you did it on your own, and you can be a 4-point student who's a functional idiot whose father built a new building at Harvard, and you know that gets you into Harvard. And now that one can't fail because the father's a hedge fund manager. So then you feel, I did all this. I sacrificed my whole childhood. I never had real playtime, real time to experience just going out and playing, and now I got to go into the workplace. Now you go down to Wall Street, and there's 175,000 other people who were just like you, and now you got to compete with them. It's like diving into a tank, and you're the tiny little mini shark, and you look around, there's just gigantic white sharks, the big ones, and they're all looking for blood. And you realize what that does to your self-esteem, how you can overcompensate and have no life at all, just have a professional career. And that's when I finally end up seeing them in my office, when they've succeeded and wanted everything in life, and they've lost everything that was meaningful, from relationships, Well, my dog died, you know. Well, it was 14 years old, and I don't remember ever spending any time with the dog. Now it's gone. I'm sad. Sad for yourself out of self-pity, or sad for the dog that it was always there and would never betray and couldn't wait to see it, yet you just never made it important. And the kids the same way. I don't know why my kids, you know, I had this conversation, by the way, yesterday with a physician. And the physician said, I don't know why my two sons ended up being drug addicts and hate-filled. And, well, let's see. Did you spoil them? Well, I mean, no more than anyone else. And then when he started telling me everything he did for the kids, oh, yeah, they were spoiled. Where did they have a chance to be themselves? They didn't. And there's a consequence. So you see, before you have a child, think about what you're putting into the genetic structure, the genome of that developing fetus. Your fears, your insecurity, your uncertainty are going to be embedded right into that fetus. So that's why I ask people, take your time, clean, detoxify, de-stress, and most importantly, reground yourself in the authentic self. Pull away from everything that doesn't honor you as a human being. And that way, that's the good gene that you're creating, the one that will not allow a child to be born already insecure. And by the way, that's exactly what this study said. You know, the feeling of constantly being on edge, always having to take care of everything, not being able to find a balance. If an expectant mother is strongly stressed over a longer period of time, the risk of the unborn child developing a mental or physical illness later in life, like ADD or cardiovascular disease, increases substantially. And the precise mechanism of how stress affects the baby in the womb is through the genes and the stress hormones which imprint on the genes. So if your mom was stressed, there's a higher probability the child will be stressed also. From the University of South Denmark, published in Research in Microbiology, the omega-3 fatty acids, that's your good fatty acids, could help protect against foodborne pathogens. That's important because we have a lot of contaminated food out there with Listeria, monocyclogenes, a foodborne bacterium that's the cause of a potentially life-threatening disease, and just having more fatty acids, the good fatty acids, can switch off the specific genes that make the Listeria bacterium dangerous. So you want about 2,000 milligrams a day of the omega-3 fatty acids in your diet. From the University of Massachusetts, a good study published in the peer-reviewed journal and from the Department of Biostatistics and Epidemiology at the University of Massachusetts, vitamin D and calcium can reduce onset early menopause. Yeah, that could make it a whole lot easier to reduce the health problems associated with that transition in life. They used 116,000 nurses in this study, and they followed them for years and found out that just two things, vitamin D and calcium, if you get enough of those two every day, it can make a huge difference and help you diminish many of the menopausal symptoms. Also, the immune system promotes spontaneous heart regeneration. This is from Osaka University, which is in Japan. This is extremely important because in adult mammal hearts, cardiomyocytes do not proliferate following damage, like that caused by a heart attack, a myocardial infarction. However, the inability to proliferate is not true for all animals. And even in mammals, cardiomyocyte proliferation is known. And what they found is it's based upon the quality of your immune system. So when your immune system is strong, when you've done a lot of good for your immune system by, for example, echinacea, 200 or 300 milligrams of that, astragalus, the herb, ginkgo biloba, cayenne, pepper, vitamin D3, vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc, selenium. These are all immune modulators, and they are really good. So they build up your immune system, and that way you can have a rejuvenation even after a heart attack, and certainly it keeps your heart healthier before. And finally, from Georgetown University comes a good study that shows that resveratrol, R-E-S-V-E-R-A-T-R-O-L, resveratrol, you find this in grapes, especially in the seed and the skin, and you find it in blueberries. You find it in grape juice in large amounts. Well, this regulates neuroinflammation and induces adaptive immunity in Alzheimer's disease. So according to this study, and this was a placebo-controlled study for 1 year, was resveratrol remarkably reduced in the interleukin-4 and fibroblast growth factors. In other words, inflammation in the brain. So if you want to turn off inflammation in the brain, resveratrol helps do exactly that. And that is important. You want to be able to turn off inflammation. One last one from the University of Waterloo, and that is that your sex life is only as old as you feel. Yes and no. The closer you feel to your actual age, the less likely you are to be satisfied with your sex life. And the study looked at the attitudes of sex and aging in a group of 1,170 adults from their mid-40s to their mid-70s over a 10-year period. And it looked at all different diverse sexual orientations. And what it was is when you felt older, you were less interested in sex for a number of reasons. This was published in the Journal of Sex Research. Now, they're saying that you don't have to be lessened in your sex life, and that is true. As long as you understand how to keep your hormones younger and therefore your body more vital, zinc is essential to this. Ashwagandha is essential to this. But also in men, you should look into this. It's a simple procedure. PRP is what it's called. What they do is they simply take about 60 cc's of blood, like one large syringe. They spin it down and they collect the plasma. Now, in that, when they spin it down, they're also getting some stem cells. Then they re-inject that into the man's reproductive system, and that helps to rejuvenate as if you were 20 years old, your capacity to fill those veins. Then they have this device. I don't know what they call it. It's a device that is like a it pounds the sides of a man's reproductive system and breaks open old occlusions, scar tissue, and washes out of the system. Because a lot of men can no longer get an erection or hold an erection, or have a complete erection because they have all this blockage from riding bicycles, sitting too long, wearing too tight underwear. And these veins, if you saw the veins that are underneath your groin, between the anus and the groin, that's what really feeds in there, and there's some grain veins also. And those can become occluded or collapsed, in which case, even if you took one of these pills, like one of these Viagra pills, the blood is not going to get in there. So that has to be broken open, meaning there's a little vibration device that they use. And I spoke with a physician, asked, is it painful? But no, it's not painful. He said, it's just you have to use it about 10 or 15 times, and that opens all those pathways up, all those veins up, and re-stimulates new vein growth. So in effect, you're growing veins that can carry the blood that engorges your sexual organ as if it were young again. Now then, if you had L-arginine, the amino acid, beet juice, that stimulates, and choline, that stimulates a nerve impulse from the brain to the reproductive system and stimulates physical capacity, and then you have to have the emotional desire. So combine emotional desire with some of those techniques, and suddenly you can have an active, healthy, and hopefully fulfilling and happy sex life, no matter what age. And for women, it's a matter of lubrication, it's a matter of rebalancing hormones, getting a correct balance. It is not true that the body shuts down all estrogen production at a certain age. At menopause, it's just other organs take over. But if you start looking at the essential fatty acids again, and there's protocols. I've written protocols of helping people who couldn't have sex because it was too painful and their body was too dry. And within about 6 months, the body relubricates and sensations return and they can have normal intimate contacts, which is good. So just let you know that there's no age to which you should not be able, if you choose to have normal sexual relations. Now, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to share what I promised yesterday, and that is I'm going to share a commentary. And this is just the beginning commentary. A far more detailed commentary will follow, and I will publish the results next week on probably Monday or Tuesday. And it's a blueprint for Congressperson Cortez to take this forward and to share this on her idea of a new green plan. Any person, in my opinion, with a minimal awareness of the events happening around the planet would realize that something is terribly wrong with the climate patterns in recent years and the dramatic changes occurring in the environment. So you don't need to have a certain political leaning or level of education or be in a specific social class to realize that our days of normal are no more. They're behind us. The unfortunate hurdle is to convince our leaders, our policymakers and opinion leaders, and ourselves that we must act immediately. There is no time. It's not as if we can wait 12 years, now it's 11 years, and then start, because these events are happening at such a rapid pace, the media can merely report on them, but the science is behind. Now, I just want to give you a snapshot of climate-related events that have occurred during the past month, and the scientific reports confirming the acceleration of climate change should persuade us that humanity has entered a whole new territory. And millions of people at this very moment are feeling global warming adverse effects. Now, just during the last 2 weeks, here are the headlines. One headline: the last time there was this much CO2, trees grew at the South Pole. A study from the University of Zurich. A warming Arctic produces weather extremes in our latitude, from the Center for Polar and Marine Research. On May 28th, Chandrapur in India reached 118 degrees. That was the hottest city in the world just 2 days ago. A study uncovers surprising melting patterns beneath Antarctica's Ross Ice Shelf, Columbia University. Global sea level may rise faster than previously projected, with profound consequences for humanity. University of Bristol. 24% of West Antarctic ice sheaf is now unstable, thinning five times faster than just two decades ago. Study shows Antarctic ice is melting at a terrifying rate. University of Leeds. Rapid permafrost thaw threatens the global landscape. University of Guelph. Permafrost collapse is accelerating global carbon release. Nature magazine. Melting permafrost in the Arctic will have $70 trillion climate impact. That's 70 trillion. Lancaster University. Just one-third of the world's longest rivers remain free-flowing. Wow, McGill University. That means like the Amazon never reaches the ocean, nor the Nile. Climate change will affect animal-to-human disease transfer, University of Queensland. And then there's also the actual climate-related events that are being reported here in the United States. For example, April 2019 was the second hottest on record for the planet. March was also the second hottest on record for the globe. And all of Southeast and South Asia are experiencing record heat waves this year, including Vietnam and the Philippines. entire continent of South America had the fifth hottest April on record. And for the Midwest, for example, this morning, epic flooding in the face of climate change, Science Magazine. And that, by the way, means that it's the longest sustained flood in the Mississippi-Missouri history in America. Whole states have been flooded, like Missouri. No other option. Climate change, drought driven many to flee Guatemala. So a lot of the people coming up, wanting into our country, are not coming because they're lazy or want to feed off our welfare system. No, they're coming because their homes can no longer be supported because they can't grow anything. It's too hot. Extreme weather has made half of America look like Tornado Valley. Yeah, and rightly so. The Mississippi River reached 14 feet above flood stage. On Memorial Day weekend, Gainesville, Florida reached its highest record temperature for this time of year, 102 degrees. Wildfires tore through nearly 20 towns in the grasslands of southeast Siberia. Right now, wildfires spreading through the Yukon bordering the Arctic. And the Australian summer was the worst on record, with bats, millions of bats boiling alive, and hanging fruit was boiling on the trees. They were literally cooked on the trees. Never had that happen before. Now, those are just some of the headlines, some of the things occurring right now. So these headlines are only for the past 30 days. So you may add, there have already been a record-breaking 712 confirmed tornadoes in the United States just since January. In addition to the changing climate, there are hundreds of thousands of people who are becoming victims of environmental immigration. Most of the immigrants traveling north to the U.S. border from Central America and Mexico are climate refugees. Farmers in Honduras, Nicaragua, and Guatemala have been experiencing a horrible four-year drought. Large swaths of Mexico are going bone dry. And the crime that is increasing in Central America is one factor forcing people to migrate, yet the rise in crime, too, can have a component that is directly related to changing climate and its respective political and social conditions as well. Because in South and Central America, the poor peasants have virtually no power. And as a result, the government is not supporting them. The wealthy classes are not feeding them. So for most migrants, the choice is leave or die. California is sinking because of the failures of sustainable water management. This includes hydrofracking, which is depleting the state's water resources. In the Central Valley, the land has actually dropped, not 8 inches, 8 feet. Now imagine that, 8 feet. Now think of the infrastructure, think of the highways, think of the gas lines and water lines that would snap when the land that it's in collapses below it. Our entire infrastructure is endangered and demands a complete overhaul and renewal. But there's no budget to do it. Yet we find plenty of money to prop up our inefficient military complex. In the meantime, America's small farmers are going bankrupt. In the Southwest, we may very well witness conditions that have never been so bad since John Steinbeck's portrayal of the Dust Bowl. We no longer have normal rainfall. The reliable cycles of precipitation have been dramatically altered. Instead, many parts of the nation are experiencing rain bombs, properly called wet microburst by meteorologists, which is rapid and extreme evaporational cooling from sinking air happening within a thunderstorm, which means it would be like you getting someone spray you with a little water from a water hose, and then someone else stand above you with a 500-pound water balloon and drop it on your head. That's what these water bombs are like. The consequences are sudden, unexpected floods. There's nowhere for the water to go. And according to the prestigious Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, such intense storms and their associated flash floods are becoming the new normal and can be attributed to climate change. This year, the Mississippi and Missouri rivers experienced their highest flood levels in all recorded history. homes and communities in the areas of the river valley that never before feared floods are now being immersed in floodwaters, and they don't have insurance for it. The consequences of our new era of droughts and extreme rain have enormous consequences on the economy. Scientists at the University of Notre Dame published a study this year that not only are floods becoming more frequent, they will continue to become more powerful in the future. Farmers in the American heartland are facing their greatest challenge since the Great Depression. A few months ago, farmers started planting their spring crops on borrowed money with interest. What are they supposed to do now when enormous flooding has destroyed and rotted out their crop? One extreme weather event could be written off as a fluke. It would not raise any urgent alarms. However, now we find everywhere on the planet is being impacted. In the same world, such as a steady stream of record-breaking events happening repeated for almost a decade would galvanize our attention. We would realize that we need to act decisively and without delay. We would need a new Marshall Plan, a global Green New Deal that gathers the world's best minds, the great scientists, agronomists, energy experts, environmentalists, and conservationists. Such expertise, and independent of the prejudices and corruption of the banking and corporate and factory farms, is demanded to move our world's infrastructure to renewable energy. The technology is there. Long ago, Iceland transitioned its energy to geothermal. We've done none of that. Sadly, I find it doubtful that we will ever see a Green New Deal. We need it. I want it. And certainly nothing of the magnitude demanded in these times. For those who understand the nature of movements deeply, such as the human rights movement, anti-war and anti-nuclear, women's rights, animal welfare, etc., no matter how much science and truth are on these movements' side, it rarely, if ever, triggers immediate change. If we've been at this since the 1960s, and American culture and politics only continues to disintegrate, and people still stay in denial, want to still consume stuff, and are uninterested in how they individually can contribute, then this is not an easy cause. For example, a product on the market can be scientifically shown to be extremely dangerous for consumers. However, it can take years, if ever, to get it banned. In the meantime, the makers of the products reap huge benefits by harming or even killing consumers. Furthermore, we have the largest number of professional lobbyists and unethical public relations firms awarded for misinforming and lying to the public about climate change and our collapsing environment. This cadre of scavengers, these economic parasites, have the power and influence to manipulate university research, control advertising, dominate think tanks, and infiltrate the entire mainstream media. There is no precautionary principle in place to measure the amount of hypocrisy, fraud, duplicity that big public relations is capable of. One of the delusions they implant in the public's perception about climate change is uncertainty. Their argument is that unless there's 100% universal acceptance of an issue, then we should do nothing and only fund more research. This is what the tobacco and GMO corporations and their hench persons in the media accomplished by delaying legislative action for decades. We hear this repeatedly from the media's talking heads such as Rush Limbaugh, Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, Alex Jones, and Tucker Carlson, falsely making claims that climate change is all political and has nothing to do with science. Over the last decade, I have interviewed dozens of climate scientists here on WBAI, and ecologists and environmental activists and journalists. All acknowledge that the anthropogenic warming exists. However, for many of these individuals, we do not have much time to deal with it, or our government and media would like us to believe we do. We don't have to worry. We've got 30 years, 50 years, 100 years. No, we don't have any time left. Unfortunately, there are real people who need to be given a voice on the media waves. However, we will never find them invited. We desperately need a Green New Deal, but not with pre-selected corporate voices to serve as its spokespersons as it is now. Rather, we need people with the scientific and experimental knowledge and background to develop a viable plan that is aligned with the climate change's urgent demands. In effect, we need a Green New Deal that lacks control by outside interests that would stop it, alter it, or compromise it. We don't need another Al Gore corporatist, a green corporatist, who has a $7 billion hedge fund and isn't a vegan and doesn't use solar. No, we need real people, and we also need real scholarship from qualified sources. For example, nuclear power is not a solution, and many in the Democratic Progressive Caucus who support the deal favor nuclear energy. But nuclear power is not a sustainable solution. It is neither green nor clean. We have only to witness the aftermath of Fukushima to be convinced of this fact, as millions of gallons of radioactive water flow into the Pacific Ocean daily, destroying marine life and threatening people along the coastline. One solution is to convince our federal, state, and local leaders to go on a mass strike until the truth about climate change is taken seriously and the environmental precautions are dealt with. Private industry will not surrender its reliance upon fossil fuels. On the other hand, other nations, not so compromised by private interest and greed, are far ahead of the United States in making the transition to renewable, including China. The U.S. is controlled by an industrial power system to assure shareholders make a profit. Therefore, some protection must be provided to these companies, otherwise they will collapse. All renewable industries should be subsidized, not just solar and wind. Other transitions would be moving towards hemp to replace our over-reliance on wood and paper so we can start a national reforesting effort. We need to plant 1 trillion, that's with a T, trillion trees in the United States. And we need to plant 1 trillion trees worldwide every year for the next 10 years. Companies must be encouraged to stop relying upon plastic. There are many alternative biodegradable alternatives, but they lack the funding to make such an impact. The American public needs to be completely re-educated about the cost of its overconsumption. This includes our food and diets, especially factory animal farming, which is 18% of our nation's farming and one of the largest sources of greenhouse gas emissions. If the public can move towards a plant-based healthy diet and federal incentives are provided to the organic farming community, it would have an enormous impact, not just on the environment, but also on people's lives. A global effort needs to be enforced to reinforce our lands. Finally, we must motivate the professional class and policymakers, especially those who have been appointed as heads of corporations and governmental agencies. Ultimately, these are the people who will need to lead the way. Right now, not one government agency that I know of, not one major corporation is really green and means it. So you see, we have 71 million people who are not on our side but should be. It is our responsibility to get the lawyers, the doctors, the engineers, the corporatists, the people running small businesses. We need to get the hedge fund people. We need to get the people who have used and exploited through our capitalist system to have a day of awakening. Let it be their epiphany that they've made their money, they've shown their power. Now why don't they show their humanity? Why don't they give a largesse to the public? And why don't they support going on plant-based diets with community gardens, using heirloom seeds, non-GMOs, get rid of the pesticides? We could teach classes. It would take nothing at all to re-green our cities, to have whole parks filled with edible foods for the community, to set aside farmland that we would subsidize. There was a time when you got 40 acres and a mule if you went west. Why don't we have a new movement? Give people 100 acres and all that they need if they grow organically, and 40% of what they grow goes to local communities. And this way, we're feeding the people, the seniors, the people who are poor. We're feeding the working class, the middle class. We're feeding people who could not afford necessarily the healthier foods, and we're giving it to them locally grown, organic, and helping. This is what we need today. More to come on an upcoming program. We're out of time. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.